Labor Day weekend is one of the most popular times for car trips and travel of all kinds. We're taking that idea to the limit today with a full hour about travel and how we get around. We'll jump on a motorcycle.
We like to ride the bike.
Go for a swim.
I must have been stung 20 times off jellyfish.
Even head to outer space.
To go to Mars, we need vehicles that are highly reliable, capable of long-duration deep space flight and surface exploration.
Plus, what do you pack when you're planning a trip that will take you to every country on the planet? Thor Peterson brought rope, a knife, and a compass.
Because I thought that's the kind of stuff that's good to have when you go out into the world. But I haven't used a compass for a single thing.
But he did have plenty of adventures. I'm Carol Hills. It's a Labor Day road trip ahead on the world. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. Welcome to our Labor Day All Transportation Show. Getting around can bring out the best and worst in any of us. Our moods can shift quickly as we scurry through an airport or sit in traffic. The stress about making your connecting flight. The sadness that your vacation is over. Or the utter and complete joy at reuniting with loved ones. Those are the celebratory homecoming sounds that greeted Thor Peterson in Copenhagen last month. He'd been away on a long adventure, very long. He spent 10 years traveling the globe, visiting every single country on the planet. Thor kicks off our travel and transportation special program today. Ahead this hour, we'll listen back to some of our favorite stories about all the ways we get around on this big, beautiful planet and the irrepressible human impulse just to move. When Thor Peterson set out from Denmark a decade ago, he not only wanted to visit every country, he wanted to do it without taking a single flight. He covered more than 220,000 miles and visited 203 countries using every other mode of transportation you can imagine. I caught up with Thor last month, just a few days after he'd returned home to Copenhagen. Thor, congratulations on completing your successful adventure.
Thank you so much, Carol.
It's just sort of amazing that you were gone for 10 years. So over the past decade, you took 37 container ships, 158 trains, 351 buses, 219 taxis, 33 boats, and 43 rickshaws. What other forms of transport did you use?
I think you covered it pretty well. So the idea was that it would mostly be public transportation. And that means that the trains and buses would be the primary form of transportation. Then going out to island nations, you need to find some sort of vessel. So if there was a ferry, I would buy a ticket and that would be the easiest way to go. But there are no ferries between the Pacific island nations, for instance. And so then you go to marinas or you go to fishermen's ports or you talk to people and you find your way through.
So you mentioned you wanted to use public transport as much as possible on this adventure. What was the longest you were able to travel just on public transport?
That would probably be 5 days. I was 5 days in a train going from Ulaanbaatar in Mongolia to Moscow in Russia.
What was the most unusual form of transport you took or the most kind of unusual experience you had out there?
That's another good question. That could be a number of any forms of transportation, to be honest. A truck that I sat on top of for 2 days in the Congo. Probably the truck.
People stress out a lot about what to take on a trip. You know, you were packing for a really long trip. What did you take?
Yeah, well, I obviously brought clothes. I brought a lot of underwear and socks. And I brought a hammock. I brought a sleeping bag. I brought some books. I brought a first aid kit. Then I brought some rope. And I brought a couple of knives. And I brought a compass. Because I thought, you know, you never know. And that's the kind of stuff that's good to have when you go out into the world. And I did use the knives sort of to cut an apple and that kind of stuff. And the rope, I used that plentiful when I was drying my clothes after laundry. But I came home with the compass, and I haven't used the compass for a single thing.
Tell us about some of the most challenging logistical problems you faced on this journey.
Oh, boy. Well, leaving Tuvalu was quite a logistical challenge. I ended up being in Tuvalu for 2 months, and they have 4 government vessels, and all these vessels had different forms of issues, so they weren't quite seaworthy at the time when I was there. So it just kept getting delayed and delayed. And there are airplanes, so you could fly out, but that wasn't an option for me. So it was kind of a question about how are you going to get away from this Pacific Island nation? And it did take me 2 months to work it out.
Did you ever feel in danger or under threat at all in this 10-year-long journey?
Yes, I did. It's not very representative of the journey, but this has been over the span of nearly a decade in every country in the world and a distance that is equivalent to going from Earth to the moon. So it would be unlikely if nothing went wrong at any point. Things that I usually list would be being on board a container ship in the North Atlantic in the wintertime in a severe storm with 20-foot swell and ice in the water and not far from where Titanic went down. So that was nerve-wracking. I've been at gunpoint a few times. Three of the vessels I've traveled on board are confirmed to be at the bottom of the sea today. Wow. I had cerebral malaria at one point. That's the kind of malaria that goes to your brain that can end your life within a couple of days if it goes untreated. But in the big picture, it was quite safe.
Wow. Were you alone on this long, long journey? Were you ever traveling with people or were you just on your own the whole time?
I didn't have a travel companion along the way, although my wife did come out to visit me 27 times.
It's so interesting when I read about you, your wife was your girlfriend when this trip started, and then you got married in the middle of it. How did that work?
Yeah, we got married twice. So we cared dearly about each other, and we cared so much about each other that we didn't want to split up. Then the pandemic broke out, and I got stuck in Hong Kong. And Hong Kong was tight as a drum, so she couldn't get inside Hong Kong being my fiancé. But if we were married, then I could seek a special visa for her. So what we found out was that there's an agency in Utah that weds people online. And we went down that route. It's very much a long story, but the short version is that she got married on December 19th and I got married on December 20th due to the time difference. And we got the paperwork and I pushed it through in Hong Kong and eventually she could fly into Hong Kong. A few years later, when I finally left Hong Kong and I was well into the Pacific, she came to see me again in Vanuatu. And we saw our chance to get married. There was a German woman who ran a resort there, and she was very helpful. And we got married. We're still not officially married in Denmark, but what we do know is we're married in Utah, in Hong Kong, and in Vanuatu.
Incredible story. Now that you've been to every country on Earth, are there any you want to go back to and spend more time in?
Yes, all of them. All of them. I really feel that every country in the world has something to offer and there's something interesting. And in my case, I seem to have friends in almost every country around the world. Also because of the size of this project, I don't feel that I had enough time to explore most countries, certainly not the big countries. So there are a great deal of countries I'd like to go back to.
So you covered more than 220,000 miles in your travels. Any particular country where you really enjoyed the music? And give us a little hint on when it was.
Yeah, actually, when I was traveling through Nigeria, I discovered a Nigerian band called P-Square. And there was a hit song back then, we're talking 2015, 2016, which was called Kolabo, which is sort of a pidgin for saying collaboration, Kolabo.
It's great to hear about new kinds of music to listen to. Now, my final question, Thor, any trips planned in the near future?
Yeah, actually there is. I'm one of those lucky people who has two countries, sort of. I have one passport, though. But my father is from Denmark and my mother is from Finland, and they split ways years ago. So my mother's back in Finland, and it won't be long before I head up there and see how she lives and how she's doing.
Thor Petersen is an adventurer and public speaker. He traveled to more than 200 countries around the world. You can find more about his travels on his Instagram, Once Upon a Saga. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me.
Now let's hop on a motorbike. Motorcycles, for some, are the ultimate freedom on two wheels, even if that freedom comes with a legal mandate to wear a helmet. In California, one religious community has been looking for an exemption to the state's helmet law. The World's Bianca Hillier reports.
Mandeep Singh is a business person and social worker in Selma, California. In his free time, he likes to hop on his motorcycle and enjoys riding it with fellow Sikhs.
We like to ride the bike, and problem is here, we can't put on helmets.
They can't put on helmets because of their turbans, which they don't remove or cover up for religious reasons. Singh says turbans have a deep meaning behind them and are more than head coverings.
When we tying this turban, we remember we have to work hard, we have to pray to God, and we have to share with others, those who are in need.
Singh was speaking at a California Senate committee hearing in support of proposed legislation. It would exempt people who wear religious or cultural headdresses from wearing helmets when riding a motorcycle in the state. Senator Brian Dahle introduced the bill earlier this year after hearing from members of the Sikh community. He says it's not the first of its kind in the states.
Our own U.S. military allows the wearing of turbans and paddocks instead of requiring head covers.
International precedent also exists. Several provinces in Canada allow Sikhs to ride motorcycles without helmets. Same with the UK and India, where the Sikh religion was founded and is primarily practiced today. But in 2019, a German court struck down similar legislation, citing safety reasons. And in Australia, Sikhs have been campaigning for a helmet exemption for years, so far with no luck. California's bill also has its fair share of opposition.
I will not be able to support this bill today.
Senator Scott Wiener urged lawmakers to be cautious.
When someone has a head injury because of a motorcycle accident because they're not wearing a helmet, it affects them and their family and their children. It affects the entire community. It affects the healthcare system.
The County Health Executives Association of California and the Automobile Club of Southern California also oppose the bill. In an email, the Auto Club pointed out that helmets reduce the risk of head injuries from motorcycle crashes by 69% and deaths by 37%, according to the CDC. In a phone interview, Senator Dahle told me he understands the safety concerns, but says adults should be able to make their own choices.
The only person that's going to be impacted is them. And so for me, it's more about the freedoms and their customs than it is about safety.
One Canadian company is trying to achieve both goals with their prototype called Tough Turban.
Having an option to wear the Tough Turban is amazing. It's the best of both worlds. You've got the safety aspect of it. I'm actually very excited to see how they pulled this off.
A promotional video shows Sikh motorcyclists wearing what looks like a typical turban, but it's made of high-tech fabric and 3D-printed protective armor. The Tough Turban hasn't hit production yet, but anyone can download the designs online for free. I asked Senator Dahle if the product is something the Sikhs he represents would consider.
No, not really. But as legislation goes, sometimes there's give and take, so we haven't really went down that path.
The bill passed the California Senate this spring, and it's now going through committee hearings in the Assembly. For The World, I'm Bianca Hillier.
Let's stick with two wheels and a mode of transport also raising safety concerns, e-scooters. They're convenient, they're annoying, and as of last week in Paris, they're gone. During the pandemic, rental e-scooters saw a tremendous rise in popularity among Parisians. Lime, one of the leading e-scooter rental companies worldwide, told The World last year that in Paris, they had more than 400,000 riders every month. That was around the time that Paris began to heavily debate whether these scooters belonged on the streets at all.
C'est vraiment une jungle urbaine.
They've turned the city into an urban jungle, David Belliard told us last year. He's the Paris deputy mayor in charge of transport and public spaces. In 2022, there were dozens of injuries and four deaths in Paris, all tied to people using the e-ride sharing services. Other Parisians we talked to at the time agreed with Belliard's sentiments.
It's very dangerous. There are a lot of accidents. No paying attention, no stop to light, no nothing. So even for bike, it's a bit dangerous.
And so in April, Parisians voted overwhelmingly to put the brakes on the city's contracts with the three vendors that supplied self-service e-scooters across the city. As of September 1st, you cannot rent one in Paris, but you can still ride your own private scooter all over town. Just ahead, our Labor Day travel show takes to the skies. You're listening to The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. You might be on the road this Labor Day weekend. Today, we're doing some traveling, too, devoting our entire hour to stories about transportation. For our next story, we're going really big on that idea, to outer space. Last fall, NASA launched the first phase of the Artemis program. It aims to return people to the moon in preparation for future travel to Mars. On the eve of the launch last September, I spoke with Nujood Maransi, the chief of NASA's Exploration Mission Planning Office.
Tomorrow, we're launching Artemis 1, which is really the first flight, the test flight of the new Artemis program. And with that, the vehicles, the Space Launch System, which is our rocket, and the Orion spacecraft, which is the spacecraft that will eventually carry humans to the moon and back.
So, of course, I'm dying to know about this sustainable presence that NASA hopes to set up on the moon. What will that look like, and how will it support a mission to Mars?
So with Artemis, we really are intending that this is a sustaining and a long-term project. So we are beginning with Artemis 1, which is our uncrewed demo, but the plans for the future include an orbiting platform called Gateway, which will be in orbit around the moon, and a human landing system, which will take crews down to the surface of the moon and eventually be able to build out systems on the surface for ever longer exploration missions. We're looking to get up to 30 days on the surface in the future. But all of this is necessary because to go to Mars, we need vehicles that are highly reliable, capable of long-duration deep space flight and surface exploration.
Nujood, what's the significance of the Artemis program compared to past programs?
One is the sustainable aspect and the ability for us to do this on a budget, on a timetable, on the elements that can be contributed to within the whole NASA portfolio. And the second goal, and really the, you know, one of the other main initiatives as we do this, is that when we go back to exploration, it'll be done in the Artemis program representing all of humanity, really all of the nation in the world, and that we have a very diverse astronaut corps, very diverse workforce. And this is really, you know, a goal of Artemis is to land the first woman and person of color on the moon. So not just the technological and sustainable methods, but the sort of personal and humanitarian aspect.
It's been decades since the last person stepped foot on the moon. In that time, what has NASA learned about space exploration around the moon, specifically that allows this mission to be possible?
In the last few decades, NASA has really perfected the art of, you know, human space exploration in the sense of we're much better at, you know, keeping the astronauts healthy. They're much safer, much better exercise and food protocols. So we're really getting good at human spaceflight. And now it's taking those lessons learned from shuttle and station and expanding them to the moon. We've also got a lot more technological data on the moon. A lot of the lunar reconnaissance orbiter images came back. We've got mapping data for the South Pole. And that's one of the objectives of Artemis is getting to the South Pole of the moon, where there's a lot more scientific interest, permanently shadowed regions that don't have any sunlight and have potential water trapped in the regolith. So a lot of the things in the, you know, human space, the sustainability of keeping humans alive in space, as well as the technology of the moon, were able to apply to Artemis.
I guess a follow-up to that is that since the last time a person did step on the moon was 1972, why has it been so hard to redo something that's been done before?
I think one of the challenges and why NASA hasn't returned to lunar exploration in the last few years is really that investment, right? It's gotten to the point with the commercial space, with all of the rocketry, with advanced computer and technology that we can do this on a sustainable budget where NASA as a whole, everything, the Mars missions, the aerospace technology and spaceflight is half of 1% of the federal budget, which is nothing compared to Apollo's 5%.
How soon will people be making this journey?
It'll be actually relatively soon. With this flight of Artemis 1, this is the uncrewed demonstration, which lets us know that all of our systems, the engineering and the design is safe for crew. And we plan to fly crew on the very next mission, Artemis 2.
Nujood Maransi is the chief of NASA's Exploration Mission Planning Office. She spoke to us last September on the eve of the Artemis 1 launch. The launch of Artemis 2 is planned for November of 2024. Flying a little closer to home now, scientists have been researching the prevalence of turbulence in air travel and have reached two conclusions. One, turbulence is more common than it used to be. And two, climate change might be the reason. This spring, the world's Marco Werman talked with Paul Williams, a professor of atmospheric science at the University of Reading in the UK, about his research into air turbulence.
Paul, what data did you look at for your research?
Well, it's been a tricky research problem because we've been focusing on a kind of turbulence that's invisible. It's called clear air turbulence, and it's got nothing to do with storms and clouds, but rather instabilities in the atmospheric jet streams, which are these really powerful currents of air. And when we crunch those numbers, we find that, for example, there's today 41% more severe clear air turbulence over the US, 55% more over the North Atlantic than there was just four decades ago. And as you've hinted, it's climate change that is behind these increases.
Yeah, so you're flying along happily enough. You see the ground clear as a bell, no clouds, and suddenly a big bump. How certain are you that the cause of the increased turbulence is climate change?
There's been a suspicion hanging around for many years now that climate change would be increasing turbulence. The new thing in our new study that's just come out is that now we see that the turbulence has already begun to increase in observations. If you're up at 40,000 feet, the temperature difference, the north to south temperature difference across the jet stream is being amplified because of climate change. That's strengthening the temperature difference and driving stronger shear in the jet stream. And it is wind shear in the jet stream that causes turbulence. So we've put together all the pieces of the jigsaw, and we're fairly confident that this increased turbulence over the past four decades is entirely consistent with our expectations of what climate change should be doing.
So we know that bumpy air is not going away. Well, what do you think needs to be done, and who needs to do it? Is it government regulations or the airlines?
It's both, and passengers as well. Of course, the simple advice is just to keep your seatbelt fastened at all times. That's what the pilots do. It's certainly what I do when I fly. You're virtually guaranteed to be safe if you do that. The worst that can happen, and this is really rare, is that the turbulence can force the overhead luggage bins to pop open and a piece of luggage can fall out and hit someone. This has happened, but it's very rare. As a word of comfort, I suppose, and some of your listeners might be on their way to the airport as they're listening to this, only 0.1% of the atmosphere at flight cruising levels has severe turbulence in it that's strong enough to lift you out of your seat if you're not seatbelted. So the chances of your particular flight seeking out this 0.1% of the atmosphere are pretty small. The thing is, though, of course, that if you add this up over all the planes that are in the skies, sooner or later, one of them will encounter it, but it's almost certainly not going to be yours. So I hope that's some sort of comfort to listeners who are heading to the airport in the coming days and weeks.
Well, I'll certainly take it, Paul. Thank you for that.
Thanks, Marco. It's my pleasure.
That's Paul Williams, an atmospheric scientist at the University of Reading in the UK, talking about his research published last spring that shows an increase in air turbulence. More stories about travel and transportation still coming your way this hour. You're listening to The World. For Americans, the car evokes freedom and wanderlust, but a lot of our old clunkers end up on car lots in West Africa.
This one is the Dodge Ram pickup.
Where is it coming from?
It's coming from the United States of America.
Good deals to be had, but that's not the whole story. Plus, is it time for an entirely different kind of tire? Reinventing the wheel, still ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. Labor Day often marks the last big travel rush of the summer season. So we're devoting today's show to just that, how we get around, at present and in the future. In the ongoing effort to transform the car industry from fossil fuels to electric, there is one element that reigns supreme, lithium. In Chile, a country rich in lithium, extraction is happening fast. But mining operations are also having some negative impacts, as the world's Tibisay Zeya first reported last fall.
Next stop.
Looking around on the Boston subway, I see cell phones, digital watches, e-books, and tablets. I'm holding a digital recorder. I've also got a laptop and a camera in my backpack. All of these devices have something in common. They use lithium batteries. In recent years, the global demand for lithium has skyrocketed, and it's expected to rise at least 300% in the next decade. That's no surprise for people in northern Chile. This is a lithium mine in the Atacama Desert, not far from Chile's border with Bolivia. Here, a machine is pulling water from the ground, pumping it into huge, shallow evaporation pools. The liquid is super salty, 10 times saltier than seawater, and it's called brine.
Bueno, el proceso consiste en extraer salmueras desde el Salar de Atacama.
Osvaldo Yáñez is a manager with SQM, a Chilean company that runs the mine.
El sol va entregando energía y va evaporando el agua.
The sun evaporates the water in these pools, he says, and the lithium becomes more concentrated.
El Salar de Atacama tiene las mejores condiciones para
poder evaporar. Yáñez says the Atacama salt flood has the highest solar radiation levels on Earth. It also never rains here, so the water in the pools evaporates quickly. It goes from turquoise to yellow in 18 months. Then the lithium is extracted from the liquid, turned into a white powder, and shipped to places like China and the US, where it's used to make rechargeable batteries. Lithium prices have hit record heights this year. That's good news for Chile's economy. This South American country meets about one-third of the globe's lithium demands. Nearby, both Bolivia and Argentina are developing their lithium mining industries as well. Experts say the resource will soon be a game changer for the economy of the whole region, which is known as the Lithium Triangle.
There's a huge opportunity.
Juan Carlos Zuleta is a Bolivian researcher who's been following the lithium business for decades. He says the real opportunity goes beyond just extracting and selling lithium.
We have all the mineral resources that are necessary to produce next generation lithium batteries and next generation EVs.
He's researching a possible association between six countries in South America to fabricate and sell electric vehicles.
My idea is basically to create a hub of lithium batteries and electric vehicles in South America for the regional market. If we are able to produce next generation EVs in South America, then we could become a superpower.
But lithium mining with those huge evaporation pools has downsides too. James Blair is an anthropologist at Cal Poly Pomona.
Yes, this is exacerbating what is already a major problem of depleted water in one of the most driest areas of the world.
Indigenous peoples in the region worry that these mining operations threaten irrigation methods they have relied on for centuries. Rudencindo Espíndola is an indigenous topographer and an activist with the National Observatory of Salt Floods in Chile. He says green technologies are good for humanity, but the price of producing them will be paid by Chile's environment. The question is, Espíndola says, how much damage is acceptable? Back at the mine, Osvaldo Yáñez says the company is working on ways to conserve water.
Todavía tenemos algunas mejoras que hacer en cuanto a la utilización de agua.
The idea is to extract lithium directly from the brine without having to evaporate so much groundwater. But Yáñez says this will take at least 5 years to develop. In the meantime, he says the trade-offs are worth it in the name of a greener future. As global demand for lithium keeps rising, though, anthropologist James Blair says consumers can do their part, too.
By encouraging battery recycling and really just reducing car dependency, which is especially a problem in the United States.
Right now, there are about 60 million electric cars on the roads of the world. By 2030, it's estimated at 350 million. And all that lithium will need to come from somewhere. For the world, I'm Tibisa Isea, Atacama Salt Flat, Chile.
Here's a question. As American drivers slowly transition to cleaner electric cars to combat climate change, what happens to that old gas guzzler you're saying goodbye to? It could be resold, recycled, or put on a ship to Africa, where there's huge demand for cheap cars and trucks. From Accra, Ghana, Ridwan Karim Dini Osman reports on how Africa has become a dumping ground for used cars.
I'm at a second-hand car lot on the George Walker Bush Highway in Accra to meet Joshua Opoku-Ajeman.
So welcome to my garage, Ridwan.
All right, thank you.
Ajuman owns this dealership with a fleet of refurbished vehicles, all of them used and all of them imported.
This one is the Dodge Ram pickup.
Where is it coming from?
It's coming from the United States of America.
Okay.
And that one is the Ford F-150. This particular one comes from the Canada.
Okay. And what's that one?
That is Jeep Rubicon pickup.
Ajuman says he scouts online for old and used cars and then buys them at a cheap cost.
And then from there, I notify any of my partners in any location in the United States who do my shipment for me. And then the container is shipped down here.
90% of the cars on Ghana's roads are imported used cars. Many are either salvaged, obtained from accident, or cars more than a decade old. These older cars can lack airbags or anti-lock brakes and other safety features that drivers in the U.S. take for granted. At Ajuman's dealership, the repairs are done right on site. Inside the repair shop, the air is thick with the smell of gasoline and oil. Dozens are working on engines. Others are pounding out dings and giving the cars a fresh paint job.
We have a chain of employees too as well. We have auto sprayers, we have auto electricians, auto air condition technicians, we have key programmers. They depend solely on this industry.
Kwesi Kranting is wearing overalls covered in paint and dirty oil. He's a supervisor here. He's been refurbishing old and used cars for the past 15 years.
Majority of the people here in Ghana cannot afford brand new cars. So the demand for the used cars is on the rise. And so when the used cars are in, we do the bodywork, fix the air conditioners, and do other servicing too.
But as these vehicles traverse the streets, many release a toxic cocktail of air pollutants. It's common to see trucks and cars belching black smoke. Those vehicles typically lack modern emission controls. Or their catalytic converters, which filter the exhaust, are removed and sold for their valuable metals. These old cars are one of the reasons that Accra's traffic-clogged streets are among the most polluted in the world, says Cordy Aziz of the Institute for Environmental and Sanitation Studies at the University of Ghana. She says on average, air pollution in Accra is 11 times higher than the World Health Organization sets as safe.
The air pollution becomes more centered in highly populated areas where you see a lot of vehicle traffic. These are all areas that have shown to have higher levels of air pollution based on the EPA sensors that were placed around the city.
But that is not all. When these used cars can no longer ply the road, they end up in the hands of scrap dealers who dismantle them for various parts, including the batteries.
Most of these used lead acid batteries are poorly discarded and become dismantled by heating them up to produce lead ingots.
That's Wilson Baku. He works with Pure Earth, a New York-based NGO that works to curb toxic pollution in low- and middle-income countries. Along with UNICEF, they found that up to 800 million children have dangerously high levels of lead in their blood, a neurotoxin that can cause permanent brain damage.
These uncontrolled smashing releases chemicals into the environment that produce chronic health effects.
Ghana tried to implement a ban on the import of used cars older than 10 years in 2020. But the government backed down after pushback from importers. This worries Chinenyewa Okoro Onu, an environmental sustainability consultant with Wete Advisory in Lagos, Nigeria.
The worst case scenario would be that these used cars will not meet the emission standards set by the country of origin, and therefore have even worse environmental impacts in Africa.
The gas guzzlers that are no longer on the road in high-income countries, she says, just end up in poor ones. Okoro says a range of incentives, like tax breaks and subsidies, are needed to shift Ghanaians into driving electric cars. But the government faces political gridlock, evidenced by the struggle to ban older cars. And as long as used vehicles are so popular in Ghana and an entire industry survives on importing them, repairing and painting them, then clean and safe cars are a long way down the road. For the world, I am Ridwan Karim Dini Osman in Accra, Ghana.
We'll get back in the car later this hour, but for now, let's hit the rails. In Japan, trains are powered mostly by electricity, often generated by coal-fired power plants. One train operation in Tokyo, though, is bucking the trend by powering trains with renewable electricity. From Tokyo, here's Chisanka Sirapala, who first reported this story last summer.
Trains are what keeps Japan's capital city moving. They transport a whopping 20 million people every day around Tokyo. Passengers are cramming into train carriages during morning rush hour. At first glance, the trains on this platform look like a relic from the 1980s. What's less obvious is that these trains don't leave a carbon footprint. The Tokyo Railway Corporation is one of 30 private train operators in Japan, and it's the first to switch to renewable sources of electricity, reducing emissions equivalent to 56,000 households. The project was launched in 2019. Company spokesman Satoru Nishino says Tokyo Railway is trying to find creative ways to use less electricity and cut costs. Some train cars have been in use for decades, he says. They use a lot of electricity, just like old cars, so they're being replaced by newer ones. Hironori Kato is a transport expert at the University of Tokyo. He says the decision to switch to renewables is ambitious.
Of course, that is a quite challenging task for them because you know that the COVID-19 pandemic seriously negatively damaged their revenues. Ridership is declining quite significantly. Therefore, they are suffering from the lack of revenues from the tickets. And also, of course, by using the renewable energies, probably the cost is more expensive than using traditional energy source.
Last year, renewables accounted for an estimated 21% of all electricity generated in Japan. The government aims to double that percentage by 2030, and it wants to achieve net zero greenhouse gas emissions by 2050. Railway networks crisscross the nation, and they'll be in for big changes. But there's one challenge. There's no single nationwide electricity grid in Japan. Llewellyn Hughes is with the Crawford School of Public Policy at the Australian National University. He tells me that the power grid on Japan's four main islands were built by nine different electricity companies. Each one serves a particular region, and Hughes says that will make it difficult to switch to renewable energy.
If you want to build a lot of offshore wind, or you want to build a lot of onshore wind or solar somewhere a long way from Osaka or Kansai or from Tokyo, you've got these narrow pipes.
Other train companies in Tokyo are beginning to decarbonize their rail networks. This signals a big shift in the private sector, and Hughes says it's going to push the Japanese government to make some much-needed upgrades to the grid.
They have essentially gone to the government and gone to their electricity providers and said, look, we've got a global commitment to decarbonize our electricity supply, and you need to build a system that lets us do that. And that's been quite influential in helping push that system forward in Japan.
Satoru Nishino, the spokesman from Tokyo Railway, says the company is gearing up to expand its use of renewable energy. We are looking at renewable energy sources for office buildings, he says, and that includes reducing CO2 emissions during building construction. Nishino says the key to cutting carbon emissions is through cooperation, not competition. For the world, I'm Tisanka Sirapala in Tokyo.
As we're thinking today about all the ways we move around, let's not forget the power of the human body to go long distances. Back in June, Adam Diver gave us a good example when he became the first person to swim from the coast of the UK to the Isle of Man in the middle of the Irish Sea. The former army captain took 55 hours to complete the feat. Still in his wetsuit on the beach, he described the achievement to ITV News.
I was pretty exhausted. The last few miles have been pretty horrific. But the last mile, when I could hear and I could see people, that was when it started to really hit home.
The last few miles may have been horrific, but the entire swim was a challenge.
I must have been stung 20 times off jellyfish. I got one in the face off a lion's mane jellyfish. It was pretty big. That was pretty awful.
Stung in the face. Ugh. It's 32 miles as the crow flies from the UK to the Isle of Man, but Diver estimates he actually swam 46 miles thanks to the changing currents. When it comes to car pollution, we tend to focus on what comes out of the tailpipe. But cars also emit another form of pollution that we don't often think about: the tiny bits of rubber that wear off our tires. The problem could get worse. With more electric vehicles on the roads, weighed down by heavy car batteries, tires on those cars are expected to wear out up to 50% faster. Gunnlaugr Erlendsson is the CEO of the UK-based startup Enzo. He spoke last spring with the world's Marco Werman about how to reinvent the wheel.
I know that tires wear down, G, but I never really considered where it all goes. Explain what happens.
Basically, what happens when a tire meets the road or the rubber meets the road, we have friction as we drive, as we roll on the streets, as we turn, as we stop, and as we accelerate. Each one of them generates effectively fine dust from the tire. And this fine dust sometimes is so fine that it's airborne. And these particles are so fine that until very recently, they'd not even been captured or measured. But in the last few years, there's been an enormous amount of research into this. We're now at the stage in the UK where the environmental agencies have confirmed we're breathing more tire dust than tailpipe dust. This is one of the largest sources of microplastic pollution from the Western world into our oceans.
One big problem seems to be the antioxidant added to tires to prevent cracking. Tell us about that and the impacts of this product on the environment.
So this has been mainly research done in California and the west coast of the United States on a material called 6-PPD. And the researchers there have identified the toxicity nature of this in terms of salmon population and other species of fish. Effectively, for years, there were these mass die-offs in estuaries along the western coast of the United States. But nobody could explain why these die-offs would suddenly happen until fairly recently, where it was connected, of course, to this material called 6-PPD, which is commonly used in most tires as effectively a preservative for the tire itself over its life. Once it rains, this material, which has been then, of course, on the roads, get washed through the drains into these estuaries and effectively causes these massive die-offs. And of course, this is something that the tire industry is not really keen to discuss. But ultimately, when we're looking at this, this has much wider implications in terms of including looking now at human health.
Now, with electric vehicles that have heavy batteries that weigh much more than a combustion engine, that's going to wear out tires even faster. Is that going to make this problem worse? Is that inevitable?
Yes. We, of course, know EVs are heavier, and simple physics dictates that a heavier vehicle will wear tires faster. So with EVs, you have generally higher wear. Michelin says up to 20% faster. Goodyear has stated up to 50% faster.
Well, some governments are trying to do something about this. The European Union is planning to set standards for tire emissions. California is going to require tire makers to explore alternatives. Is the global tire industry, though, ready for change?
To be honest, they have to be forced to change, just like we had other tailpipe regulations since the 70s. And California, of course, led the charge in that regard when it set some of the world's first air pollution standards. But that's over 50 years ago when that started to tick along. So you can imagine how long it might take. We don't have enough time like that anymore to address this problem. The tire industry has to, of course, embrace the problem and work with regulators to solve it. But to be honest, today there is no law anywhere on this planet against making tires that wear out really quickly or are inherently toxic, apart from some minor regulations. But of course, it's highly profitable to sell tires that are made out of cheaper raw materials that you get to sell more often because they wear out quickly. Underlying the whole industry, of course, is a business model that focuses on churn.
Right. And so how do we get around that? That seems to be a fundamental problem with all this.
It is the fundamental problem, because while the business model of both the manufacturers of tires and the distributors of tires are focused on selling more tires, ultimately what we need to focus on here is changing the underlying incentives. And so selling directly to the customer is something Enzo is developing. And we also then look to sell these tires as a service to customers. Because once we provide the tire onto the vehicle as a service, something very fundamental happens. And that is we convert the business model from the churn to durability, because the longer you can make that tire last, the less pollution it'll generate.
So is it possible to make tires out of something other than rubber?
Well, rubber comes in two formats. You have synthetic rubber, which comes from the fossil fuel industry, and you have natural rubber, which comes from trees. The rubber that is synthetic and comes from fossil fuels has a really high carbon input to manufacture, while the one that grows on trees actually sequesters carbons. So actually, we want more natural rubber and less synthetic rubber. The irony is, of course, all cars today, and including all electric cars, run on tires made from fossil fuels. So even if we switch all cars to EVs tomorrow, we end up still having to pump oil out of the ground to make the tires. If we see a carbon neutral future in front of us, we have to reduce, of course, our reliance on fossil fuels and more relying on renewable recycled. So as we make tires more efficient and less polluting, we can actually hope for a better future.
Gun lawyer Erlendsson heads the UK-based tire startup Enso. It's looking into what can be done to make tires more environmentally friendly. Thanks very much for your insight. Really appreciate it.
Thank you so much. Have a good day.
Before we go, here's a little reminder for you listeners in your cars. Watch your speed, especially if you're in Finland.
The first thing we noticed when we came over the border into Finland was the number of speed cameras.
Foreign visitors learn Finland's rules of the road pretty quickly.
Okay, speed limit.
A video there in Hindi called How to Drive in Finland. There are plenty of legit reasons to watch your speed when driving on Finnish roads. Moose, deer, even reindeer step into traffic. So Finland has strict enforcement of speed limits and a unique system for paying a ticket based on your daily income. The more you earn, the more you pay. This Helsinki cop explained it to Euronews.
The minimum is 6 euros per day fine, so it's always at least that, but it can go all the way to tens of thousands.
That's right, tens of thousands of euros for a speeding ticket. In June, a Finnish multimillionaire made headlines when he was fined nearly $130,000 for driving 50 miles per hour in a 30-mile-per-hour zone. Yep, we actually converted it from kilometers for you. It's one of the largest fines in history because the driver, Anders Wiklof, is one of the wealthiest people in Finland. So lay off the gas, even if you're not in Finland. And with that, our Labor Day transportation show is peeling out of here. The world comes to you each weekday from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. I'm Carol Hills. Enjoy the rest of your holiday weekend.